readers. Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Charles, Elaine Charles, and this week's mission, which I hope you'll accept, is an investigation of a genre so many of us love: spies, espionage, covert ops. We're set to uncover a new crop of nonfiction titles, plus yarns of intelligence and intrigue starring some of your favorite operatives. Yes, our mission begins as we turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do: socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Robert Baer was known inside the CIA as one of the best operatives working in the Middle East. But if his career was all that a spy might aspire to, his personal life was a sad illustration of everything a spy is asked to sacrifice. Dana Williamson thought of herself as an ordinary California girl. But then she joined the CIA and soon distinguished herself as someone who could thrive in the field. Tapped to serve in some of the world's most dangerous places, she discovered an inner strength and resourcefulness she'd never known, but quickly found out about the heavy toll a spy life exacts. When Bob and Dana met on a mission in Sarajevo, it wasn't love at first sight, but there was something there. The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story, is a wonderful read or listen about the day-to-day life of intelligence operatives. I really enjoyed it, though warning, when you start listening, the matter-of-fact narration by the authors with Richard McGonagall might put you off a bit. But I urge you to keep listening. You will be drawn into their world and get a compelling portrait of real life inside the CIA. The periods of boredom and frustration, loudly punctuated by fast-moving and sometimes frightening, sometimes amusing, intelligence operations. Bob and Dana Baer are the real deal.
Author's note: all events in the story are true. However, to protect sources and methods, the names of operatives and informants have been changed and their identities blurred beyond recognition. For instance, we describe the organization that Yuri works for as the Russian KGB, although by 1991, the KGB had been dissolved into multiple organizations. The term parabolic mic substitutes for a device that is still classified. The names of the people who helped with the adoption have been changed because they belong to Pakistan's imperiled Christian minority. Special thanks goes to our editor, Rick Horgan, who first saw the possibility of this book and whipped it into the shape it needed to be in. The CIA has reviewed the book to ensure that it contains no classified information.
The bottom line is, there aren't any textbooks on spying. You have to invent as you go along. Robert Little, The Company, a novel of the CIA.
That was The Company We Keep by Robert and Dana Baer. My guest today, Stephen Hunter, was born in Kansas City, Missouri, but grew up in Evanston, Illinois. After graduating from Northwestern in 1968 with a degree in journalism, he was drafted into the Army and later wrote for a military paper, the Pentagon News. He joined the Baltimore Sun in 1971, working at the copy desk of the newspaper's Sunday edition for a decade. He became its film critic in 1982, a post he held until becoming the Washington Post's film critic in 1997. In 2003, he received the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism. Hunter's thriller novels include 7 in the Bob Lee Swagger Vietnam Vet series, plus 2 spin-off series, a trilogy centered on Bob Swagger's father, Earl Swagger, and now, Soft Target, focusing on Bob's long-unknown son, Ray Cruz. Welcome, Stephen. Thanks for stopping by the Book Report.
It's my pleasure, Elaine. I'm very happy to be here.
So, Stephen, you really hate shopping, huh? How did you weather this holiday shopping season?
I'm strictly a one-click shopper. If it weren't for one click, I would be known as Scrooge because I wouldn't give any presents. But that one click has pretty much saved my social reputation.
All right. So your new book, Soft Target, is set in Minnesota's Mammoth Mall, America the Mall. Your descriptions of the place are so vivid. I'm assuming you visited and spent quite a lot of time there?
I spent a fair amount of time there. I was more interested in visual impressions, in sense impressions, in the feel and the look and the gestalt of the place than I was in doing any kind of hardcore reporting. Everything about mall security, everything about mall software, everything about mall protection, that's all fictional because, of course, I didn't want to divulge anything, A, and B, because I'm too lazy to ask anyone any questions. But I did try and sort of create, and it's a metaphorical mall. I mean, it is that mall, but it's also all malls, as I'm sure you realize. Mm-hmm. And I did try and create the sensibility and the sense of being in the mall as vividly as possible.
For listeners who may not know, what does the title Soft Target actually refer to?
A soft target, the best definition is the rest of us. In other words, there are lots of hardened targets in America that are heavily protected both architecturally and by manpower and I suppose also conceptually, military targets, leadership targets, political targets, government installation targets, that sort of target. But sort of normal citizens living their lives and doing their jobs, we could be on the bullseye as we were on 9/11. And there's very little has been done to protect us, and very little has been, it's not part of the popular imagination. Whenever large numbers of vulnerable people gather, that's a particularly enticing soft target.
It all takes place on, tell the readers a bit about it. It's terrorist takeover, the largest mall in America, and the time frame of the book.
The book is set in about 4 hours, and it begins the moment this episode begins, this attack begins in the mall, and it stays with it for 4 hours with a couple of flashbacks to explain who the terrorists are and how the operation was put together. But it's set in real time. You ought to be able to read it in about the time that it takes to actually unravel in the narrative. And the book flashes across the mall. It looks at the hostages. It looks at the hostage takers. It looks at the first responders. It looks at the SWAT officers trying to figure out what to do in this terrible, terrible situation and some of the command decisions that they have to make. It looks at some private citizens who feel obligated to get engaged because they have special training. And it just sort of takes you through that long, dangerous, and bloody day. And at least my hope is that when you're done with it, you'll have to change your clothes and take a shower because you sweated through what you were wearing. And once you get out of your shower, your first thought will be, I need a drink.
Well, I tell you, it was a very gripping book, and I enjoyed reading it. But you didn't turn me off shopping at malls. I'm still going to brave it.
So. Well, you know what? The truth is, I love malls. And I had many choices. If I was going to do a book like this, it could have been a football game. It could have been a train station or an airport. It could have been anywhere. But I'm of that first generation of mall goers. I was a kid in the 50s, and in the late 50s when the malls first came into existence, they just beckoned us like, you know, magic caravans from the east.
Your book encapsulates a struggle between the various law enforcement agencies, the local police, the feds, the military. We see so much of this on TV cop shows. How real is it?
Well, it's pretty real, and I did speak to several FBI agents about that. And, of course, usually what we do is we get a projection of the ideal of what happens in circumstances like that. But, you know, it's my experience that the ideal never occurs. That's why it's ideal. And it's also my experience from 35 or 40 years of office politics that nothing happens smoothly, that there are always cliques, that there are always complexities, there are always buried grudges, there is always ambition. There's a whole play of human ambition and folly and strength and weakness in any kind of, in any office on any given moment, but that's exacerbated and accelerated under crisis situations. And so I've always, I mean, it's consistent with me throughout my books. One of my ways of trying to give a feel of realism is to de-idealize the apparatuses that control emergency situations or military situations and portray them as sort of cranky, eccentric political organizations. And I just feel that certainly matches my own reality in the workplace.
Early in the story, the head of the Minnesota Police, Obobo, thinks or describes the crisis as almost a gift in terms of the national attention it would gather for him. That's chilling. In your opinion, is that actually how some law enforcement professionals think?
I would hope and pray not.
Are there any plans to turn Soft Target into a movie?
Not yet, but I'm speaking as a cunning, low, meretricious, money-grubbing capitalist. I will tell you that one of my ideas, and why should I deny it, was to create a scenario which could make, it seems to me, a movie without, you know, I mean, it's been, either to its credit or to its disgrace, many people are calling it a treatment, and it does have a cinematic quality which I bring to it, not because I want to sell it to the movies, but because I saw so many movies, the cinematic quality is sort of sunk into my DNA, and I would love to see it become a film.
Well, Stephen, what's next for you?
Well, I'm very excited about my new project. It's a book I've been working on for 49 years. Even I started working on it, obviously, before I knew I would be working on it. And in it, Bob Lee Swagger, he comes off the porch for one last grand adventure, and he confronts an ancient and extremely vile American crime from 49 years ago. Hint, 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 hint. And this, his investigation takes him both to Dallas and to Mexico. Oh. I'm sorry, both to Dallas and to Russia. And I believe that he finds some questions to ask that have never been asked before, and he finds some answers that have never been answered before. And I think the book is going to give, I'm very excited. I can't wait to be finished with it because I think it's so, I've had such a great time working on it, and it's going to look at 1953 all over again. It's called The Third Bullet. It'll be out late next year from Simon & Schuster, and I think it's really something special.
All right, well, we're looking forward to it because I loved Soft Target. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Elaine. I hope my aunt, I talk too much. I know. She just slapped me in the mouth and said, shut up.
But not
anyway,
at all.
Anyway, thanks for indulging.
All right, thanks. See ya. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now, let's hear a sampling of Soft Target, a breakneck thriller in which ex-Marine sniper Ray Cruz must outwit a group of murderous Somali terrorists who've laid siege to the Mall of the America. Phil Gigante narrates.
We'll show up with packages and make them so happy and you'll feel good. The nephews will all worship you. The sisters will wonder why you took me over them. My father will offer to make you a partner in his business. And my mom? Well, who knows about my mom?
It sounded pretty good to Ray. Family. It was something that had been taken from him years ago, on a highway outside Manila, when a drunken truck driver hit his mother and father as they drove home from a visit with her relatives. Even discovering that his biological father still lived hadn't quite filled the hole in his life. Maybe the sprawling, argumentative, rambunctious Chan clan would. He was 42 now, a few months past 22 years of gung-ho, Semper Fi, USMC lifestyle, mostly shooting and getting shot at. Ray had many scars from distant, dry or cold places, and he had many memories that sometimes, less now than before, flooded over him. Men and boys bleeding out or torn to pieces, the dysentery of fear, the yoke of duty, his own need to press on and finish, even if it finished him. What are you trying to prove, Ray? Achilles died 1,000,000 years ago. Someone's going to put an arrow in your heel, too, if you don't watch out. I'm Hector, not Achilles, Ray had replied, knowing the difference. But then, in the Washington area for a talk at one of the Alphabet Soup agencies that sought his post-retirement employment, he had met Molly Chan. And maybe it would all change. Maybe it would be better after all. It was, of all places, another gigantic mall, one out in Northern Virginia.
You look like you're about to cry,
someone had said to him as he stood at the corner of Macy's and Lord & Taylor's, baffled as to direction and destination. He turned. She was more Asian than he was, shorter than he was, and unlike his dead, flat desert of a face, adept primarily at staying neutral while people tried to kill him. Hers was lively, lit from within by intelligence and wit. And she had...
You have cheekbones, he said.
One on each side. They won't go away no matter how much I eat.
I'm half Asian, he said.
I noticed both halves, she said. I bet it's a long story.
Longer than Tolkien. Denser, too. But at least no hobbits. Anyhow, yeah, I am about to cry. Why did I come here? It's like the end of the world. I just need some underpants.
You've never been in a mall before?
Possibly. I'm not sure. I'm just out of the Marine Corps, 22 years. They may get you killed, but they do hand out free underpants.
She laughed at his little joke, and that was a kind of start. It turned out they got along. Their rhythms were right. They agreed on who the world's were. They didn't like pompous, overbearing, self-important people. They believed in hard work, modesty, repression, and honesty. Neither drank a lot. Both drank a little. Both were embarrassingly smart. What could possibly go wrong? First, it was coffee. Then it was a couple of meals. A number of enjoyably merry emails. Then a really bad movie, and then some interesting stuff happened. And here he was in suburban Minnesota, at the biggest mall in America. America, the mall, it called itself. And everywhere you looked stood the three letters, ATM, on the biggest shopping day of the year. He was visiting her parents and family, headquartered in nearby St. Paul, and on this day, the Chans went shopping en masse. The family was Hmong, that is, formerly mountain tribal Vietnamese, honorable and ferocious allies of the American war effort of the 60s and 70s, since, by political necessity, decamped to the upper Midwest. She was second generation, had only been to Asia as a tourist. She was 34 and an attorney in Washington at the Department of Energy. She was beautiful, too good for any man she'd ever met, and even now unsure why she had spoken to the trim guy in the mall looking for underpants, but glad she had. He remained vague about his past, not knowing that at a certain time, before she got in too deep, Molly called in a D.C. favor and had received a synopsis of his career highlights, all 5 tours in the suck, and the last crazy ride to hell and glory that ended in that famous missile detonation at the Rose Garden. Now, he said, as they were carried along by the current of the torrential second-floor Colorado corridor, are we at this spot by random drift, or is there a conscious destination ahead?
That was Soft Target by Stephen Hunter. From David Baldacci, a giant in the genre, comes a new hero, Army Special Agent John Puller. In Zero Day, Puller is called out on a case in a remote rural area in West Virginia, coal country. Someone has stumbled onto a brutal crime scene. A family is slaughtered. The local homicide detective, one headstrong lady, joins forces with Puller in the investigation. As Puller digs through deception after deception, he realizes that absolutely nothing he's seen in this small town and no one in it are what they seem. Facing a potential conspiracy that reaches far beyond the hills of West Virginia, he is on the hunt for justice against an overwhelming force. Ron McLarty and Orla Cassidy narrate.
He pulled into the gravel drive. This neighborhood had once been fairly nice. Well, if one went back to the 1950s. Now, it was not so nice. There wasn't a soul around. The yards were empty of kids, as though it were 2 in the morning instead of 2 in the afternoon. On a hot summer's day, the kids should be out running under the sprinkler or playing hide-and-seek. But kids didn't do that anymore, Reed knew. They sat inside in the AC and played video games so violent and gory that Reed had forbidden his grandchildren to bring them into his house. Now the yards were filled with trash and dirty plastic toys. Ancient rusted Fords and Dodges were up on concrete blocks. The home's cheap siding was popping off. Every surface of wood needed painting. And roofs were starting to collapse as though God above were pressing down on them. It was all sad and rather pathetic. It made Reed want that beer even more. Because his neighborhood looked exactly the same as this one. He knew a few privileged folks were making a fortune off the coal seams. It was just that none of them happened to live around here. He pulled the package from the postal bin and trudged toward the house. It was a tired-looking two-story with vinyl siding. The door was hollow-core wood, white and scarred. A sheer glass door fronted it. A plywood wheelchair ramp bled off the stoop. The shrubs in front of the house were overgrown and dying. Their branches had pushed against the soft siding, buckling it. There were 2 cars parked in the gravel in front of his black Ford, a Chrysler minivan and a late model Lexus. He took a moment to admire the Japanese car. Something like that would probably cost him more than a year's salary. He reverently touched the blue metallic paint. He noted a pair of aviator sunglasses hanging from the rearview mirror. There was a briefcase in the back seat and a green jacket next to it. Both vehicles' license plates were from Virginia. He continued on, bypassing the ramp, hit the bottom step, trekked up the 3 squared-off logs of poured concrete, and rang the bell. He heard the sound pealing back at him from inside. He waited. 10 seconds. 20. His irritation grew. He rang again.
Hello, mailman. Got a package, needs a signature.
His voice, virtually unused throughout his workday, seemed strange to him, as though someone else was talking. He glanced down at the 8x11-inch flat package. Attached to it was the receipt that needed signing.
Come on, it's hot as and the dollar bar is calling my name.
He glanced at the package's label and called out,
Mr. Halverson?
Reed didn't know the man, but did recognize the name from previous deliveries. Some mailmen in rural areas became friendly with their customers. Reed had never been that kind of mailman. He wanted his beer, not a conversation. He rang again and then knocked on the glass. 2 sharp raps with his knuckles. He swiped at a bead of sweat that trickled down the back of his burnt red neck, an occupational hazard from sitting next to an open car window all day with the sun beating down on him. His armpits were oozing sweat, staining his shirt. He wasn't running his car AC with the window down. Gas was expensive enough without wasting it. He raised his voice.
Hello? It's the mailman. Need a signature. If it goes back, you probably won't see it again. He could see shimmers of heat in the air. He felt slightly dizzy. He was getting too old for this. He aimed his gaze at the two cars. Had to be somebody home. He stepped away from the door and tilted his head back. There was no one peering at him from the dorm windows. One was open, making them look like mismatched eyeballs.
That was Zero Day by David Baldacci.
Have a new iPad, Nook, or e-reader? New television, laptop, iPod, or appliance? If you've been worrying if your new gadgets will still work next year, then you need Warranty of America. For just $9.95 each month, you get a 4-year extended warranty on everything you bought last holiday season, plus everything else you buy for the rest of your life. That's right, just $9.95 per month covers your entire household. It covers an unlimited number of electronics, appliances, and computers. If it plugs in, we protect it. All for just $9.95 per month. Coverage has no deductibles, no additional fees. If they can't fix it or replace it, you'll get your purchase price back. No contract. You can cancel anytime. Order now. Call 877-746-4692 or enter radio with the promotional code at warrantyofamerica.com. You'll get 1 month free, so call 877-746-4692 for Warranty of America. It'll be the last warranty you'll ever need.
The Secrets of the FBI by New York Times best-selling author Ronald Kessler uncovers the FBI's most closely guarded secrets, and the secrets of celebrities, politicians, and movie stars uncovered by agents during their investigations. Based on inside access, the book presents revelations about the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound, Marilyn Monroe's death, Vince Foster's suicide, and J. Edgar Hoover's sexual orientation. From Watergate to Waco, from congressional scandals to the killing of bin Laden, The Secrets of the FBI presents headline-making disclosures about the most important figures and events of our time. Michael Bybee narrates.
On the other hand, Cummings had no problem with the desire of both the Obama and Bush administrations to read terrorists their rights. He believed that in most cases, the FBI could obtain the intelligence it needed to stop future plots by remaining within the framework of the legal system, including by administering Miranda warnings. The trick was to confront suspects before they were in custody, give them incentives to talk, and establish rapport. Cummings himself was a genius at getting bad people to incriminate themselves. A master of eye contact, Cummings has a receding hairline that emphasizes the intensity of his gaze. His magnetic blue eyes direct energy toward his listener. It's all about parrying with the adversary, Cummings says. How many crumbs did he leave, and how many can I pick up? How do I get to the answer? How do I get to what's really happening? There are so many different ways to do it, but the best way by far is sitting across the table from someone. The best thing is when you're sinking your fangs into his neck and he's smiling while you do it because you convince him that what he's doing is in his best interest, when in fact it absolutely is not. Having been told about the Christmas Day bomber, Cummings grabbed a Snickers bar and a Coke. That would be his Christmas dinner in 2009. His wife, Ellen, and three teenagers would enjoy turkey and cranberry sauce by themselves. Cummings was now in charge of the case of Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, one of the FBI's most controversial and potentially most damaging terrorist cases. Cummings jumped in his FBI car, a Dodge Charger. He turned on the sirens and the flashing blue and red lights and raced toward FBI headquarters. Chapter 1. TAC Ops. When breaking into homes and offices to plant bugging devices, TAC Op agents try to avoid using rear doors. Since they are rarely used, rear doors could be booby-trapped. So when TAC Ops agents needed to plant bugs in a Philadelphia electronic supply company that was a front for an organized crime drug gang's hangout, they decided to walk in through the front door. Agents decided the best time for entry would be between midnight and 2 a.m. After that, trash collectors began their pickups and could see agents breaking in. The only problem was that across the street was a bar with outside seating. Patrons of the bar would spot the FBI team defeating the locks and disarming the alarm system at the front door. So TACOPS agents borrowed a city bus and rode to the electronic supply company. They parked the bus at the front door and pretended that the bus had broken down. As the FBI agent who was driving the bus lifted the hood, agents scrambled out to work on the locks and break in. Onlookers across the street could not see them behind the bus. Once the agents were in the target building, the bus drove off. When the agents had finished installing electronic bugs, the bus returned to pick them up. But the bus whizzed past 2 inebriated customers from the bar who were waiting at a nearby bus stop. When the bus stopped in front of the business, the 2 angry patrons ran for the bus and jumped in. Since many of the agents were from different offices, everyone assumed at first that the 2 men were part of their operation. "We get a couple of blocks away. We start peeling off our equipment," says FBI agent Louis E. Griever, who was on the TACOPS team for 12 years. "We've all got weapons on and radio gear, and these 2 guys are kind of sitting there going, 'What the?' They start ringing the bell. Ding, ding. They want to get off. Ding, ding." Now, the bus driver, who was from the local office, was not a very good bus driver. I think he practiced for like 20 minutes driving this bus. He was knocking over garbage cans when he made turns. He yells back, "Hey, quit playing with the bell. I'm having a hard enough time driving the bus." Other agents on the bus began to realize that the 2 men ringing to get off were not with the FBI after all. Before each job, all the agents meet each other, and now it seemed clear that these 2 were unwitting imposters.
We've just heard The Secrets of the FBI by Ronald Kessler. Stuart Wood's DC Dead is a treat for longtime fans of Stone Barrington and readers meeting him for the first time. After a shocking loss, Barrington is at loose ends, unsure if he wants to stay in New York to continue his work as a partner at Woodman & Weld. So, a summons to D.C. by President Will Lee comes as a welcome relief. The president and his CIA director wife have a special op that calls for Stone's unique skill set. It's a mission that will reunite him with his former partner in crime and in bed, Holly Barker. Tony Roberts narrates.
"You're empty nesters now," Elaine chortled. "Never thought I'd see the day." Stone shook his head. 9 months ago, I didn't have a son, at least not one I'd ever met. Now I don't have a son again." Elaine reached over and patted his cheek. "You haven't lost a son," she said. "You've gained a college boy." She got up and continued her rounds at the regulars' tables.
"I guess that's one way to look at it," Stone said. "Do you think he'll ever come home again?"
"Probably not," Dino replied. "You've seen the last of that kid."
"Oh, shut up. You're in the same spot."
"Nah," Dino said. "You're worse off. At least I'm not used to having Ben around the house all the time. He's been at prep school for 4 years, and then his mother yanked him to her place every chance she got. This afternoon, why didn't you raise the subject of visits home?"
"I thought about it," Stone said, "but I was afraid I wouldn't like the answer. After all, the kid's got the money he was paid for his film, which is more than I had a year ago, so he doesn't need me for anything."
"He just doesn't need you for buying stuff," Dino pointed out. "He still needs a father."
"You really think so?"
"Ben needs me, I'm sure of that. Why wouldn't Peter need you, what with his mother dead and all? He's got Hattie. They're sleeping together, you know."
Dino laughed aloud.
"No. What were you doing your freshman year?"
Stone shrugged. "My brain's out, if I recall correctly."
"Actually, you continued to do that, at least until you and Harrington got married."
Stone managed a smile. If anything, the activity increased after that. I'm getting worried about you, kiddo, Dino said.
You're gonna have to get back in the saddle pretty soon, or you're gonna forget how.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. It's just that, well, it's like not being hungry at dinner time. I just don't have an appetite. Dino turned and watched as a very pretty brunette in a short skirt came through the door and took a seat at the bar, crossing her long legs.
Doesn't that do anything for you?
Sort of, Stone replied. I mean, I remember what it was like, the way you remember how you roller skated when you were a kid, but it just isn't all that appealing. Dino felt for Stone's pulse and looked at his watch.
Your vital signs seem normal.
That's something, I guess.
Look who's here, Dino said,
nodding toward the door. Stone turned in time to see a tall redhead in a well-cut pantsuit enter the restaurant. She headed for their table and sat down. Hello, sailors, she said, leering a little. Stone leaned over and kissed her. Hello, Holly. What brings you to town? Dino kissed her, too.
Same question here.
Agency business, Holly Barker replied. She was an assistant deputy director for the CIA. I hope you guys remember that you're still under contract to us as consultants. How could we forget? Stone asked. Lance keeps reminding us. Lance Cabot was Holly's boss, deputy director for operations, or DDO. Well, fellas, you're about to get the call again. Stone slumped. Now what? I can't tell you, Holly replied.
Can't tell us what?
Dino asked.
That's what I can't tell you, dummy, she said.
What kind of deal is this? Stone asked.
Here's the deal. You get the daily rate specified in your contract and 500 per diem.
For how long?
Dino asked.
That depends on how good you are, she said.
Who can live on 500 a day? Stone asked.
Clearly, you've been living too well, Holly replied. If you stay at a Holiday Inn Express and eat at McDonald's, you can make money on that. Would you like my office to book you in?
Thanks, Stone said. I'll make my own arrangements.
That was DC Dead by Stuart Woods. Thomas Kaplan is a distinguished author and founder of the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. He is currently the Foundation's board member emeritus. Thomas has written three previous novels, Line of Chance, Parallelogram, Grace and Favor, and now The Spy Who Jumped Off the Screen. Thomas is a grad of the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and earned his MBA from Harvard Business School. Welcome, Thomas. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report today.
Thank you very much for having me. Delighted to be here.
All right. Your newest novel, The Spy Who Jumped Off the Screen, has a foreword from a very distinguished college classmate of yours. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, I was very lucky. It was an accident of the alphabet as a freshman. My last name begins with C, C-A-P-L-A-N, and President Clinton, then Bill Clinton from Arkansas, obviously begins with C, and so he and I were a few doors from each other. Freshman year, we later became roommates, and we've stayed friends through all that time. And when I wrote this book, which is my first thriller, I sent it to him because I knew that he was an avid fan of thrillers and knew a lot about them. And he was very kind and edited the book for me, and that helped race it along. And then when I finished the final draft, he was even kinder and wrote an introduction in which he describes that process.
Yeah. Well, you've written that while you were in college together, the president actually introduced you to many of his favorite writers. Which of his suggestions made a huge impression on you?
Yeah. Well, it was an interesting friendship because we were both very enamored of John Kennedy, who died, and of that administration. And so we had a bond in that, although we came from different parts of the country. And we had different tastes in reading. I really was beginning to think that I wanted to be a writer. I wasn't yet sure whether I wanted to be a journalist or a writer of fiction. And he obviously knew that he was interested in government and politics. And I don't think at that age he'd figured out exactly the route. But so it was interesting because effectively I was majoring in literature with a minor in politics at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service, and he was majoring in politics and government with a minor in literature. And from him I really learned, you know, quite a lot about mystery writers and thriller writers such as Eric Ambler and Graham Greene. And I think from me he probably picked up an appreciation of Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, the standard first steps of any writer.
So had you ever worked for the Foreign Service, or you...
No, I never have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been a writer and worked for a while in a family business.
All right. The hero of your latest thriller, Ty Hunter, is both a movie star and, I guess so you would call it, a U.S. Intelligence operative. Did you draw inspiration from, for example, Leslie Howard or Ian Fleming?
Not consciously, but a little bit. The idea came, I'd always wanted to write a thriller, but I didn't want to write one that was derivative of other thrillers that were out there. And I have a lot of respect for the genre, just as I do for other forms, a sonnet form, for example, in extreme case. I often like work that's forced into limits, and I've had an appreciation for the genre for years, but I didn't have the right hero or probably enough experience of certain aspects of the world when I was young. The idea of Ty Hunter actually came into my mind all of a sudden. I was thinking about California, and I was thinking about another book that I had in the back of my mind, and suddenly I was driving, and I thought, wait, the spy is a movie star, the movie star is a spy. One character in The Spy Who Jumped Off the Screen says, it's as though Matt Damon really were Jason Bourne. And what I thought was, as I came to think about it, I thought, this is a character who can take the reader into very rarefied milieus, otherwise unavailable, and where he would not stand out, but where a normal agent would. And because he is the most famous movie star in the world, his fame really deflects suspicion from him. And it's an interesting thing. And then, of course, I did think of those people, particularly Leslie Howard. And it's interesting because one of the things I thought about was that this character was a little bit like the Scarlet Pimpernel. And, of course, Leslie Howard played the Scarlet Pimpernel, famous movie.
And your wonderful villain, Philip Frost, a man with an icy heart indeed.
You're wonderful, I was.
Where did you get your inspiration for him?
I don't know where he came from.
Well, the book deals with stolen nuclear weapons. It seems very pertinent. Did you have any insider information in your research?
I learned a lot after I began to research them. When I thought of the original plot twist that allows these weapons to get loose from where they were, it was almost exactly the same as when I thought of Ty Hunter. I was doing something else completely. I was in Los Angeles, and I had just been for a swim, and I got out and I thought, wait a minute, if this happened and then that happened and then this happened again, these things could get loose. So not knowing much then about the subject, I called a great friend of mine who knew an awful lot about the subject, not president, but and I said, is this possible? And he thought about it and said, yes. And I said, well, that's really ruins the day. It's quite scary. One of the things that The Spy Who Jumped Off the Screen tries to show or explore is that we've almost had a privatization of this, of the dangers in the world. They're not just countries that can act badly, but they're non-state actors, even individuals who have enormous power, which of course would be wildly magnified should the wrong one get a hold of a nuclear weapon.
Well, I just love the way the book jet-set it all over the globe. When you were writing it, did you actually visit most of the locales?
Not for the purpose. I have visited most of the locales, but it's after visiting them that the way that they would fit into the book came into my mind. I knew Gibraltar fairly well, and I knew it well enough to think about it. And then, of course, I did more research and was back once while I was writing this book. And all of the other areas, except for the Strait of Kerch, in the north of the Black Sea, I have visited, and that I have visited extensively via Google Earth and lots of books. I am doing a sequel, so Ty will be back next year. And I'm, you know, hugely sort of invested emotionally in that. I said to somebody, you know, is this a fun book to write? Because it's not hard to get up in the morning and go to your desk when you know that for the next 8 hours you are going to, in your imagination, be 32 years old, the number one film star in the world, no financial anxiety, having to chase away all of the world's most desirable women who are constantly after you, with the fate of civilization depending on your multilingual skills and your martial arts skills and your general savoir-faire. When the editing process, one of my editors is a couple of years younger than Ty, and she said about a line of dialogue, she said, I'm not sure that he would say that, just a short line. I said, I think he would. She said, I don't think so. But we went back and forth and back and forth. Finally, I said, I do think he would. I would say it. And she said, but you're not Ty Hunter. And I said, Allison, don't ever say that to me again.
Ty Hunter is really a great character. Where can readers find out more about him?
The only thing I like to say is that all the information about the spy who jumped off the screen is on my new website, which is Thomas Kaplan, with a C, thomascaplan.com, which went up day before yesterday. And you'll find out everything there, including the very gratifying thing that Amazon picked it as one of the best books of January, which was a great boost to me the morning they did that, and nice New Year's present. And I think that there's a lot to read about Ty Hunter and about what's coming and a little more in-depth about the book itself. So I hope anybody who is interested, and I hope people will go there.
All right. Well, I know I'm looking forward to the sequel. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Right.
Very nice to talk to you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, from the Soviet invasion to September 10th, 2001, is the first-hand account of America's secret history in Afghanistan. Author Steve Cole is president and CEO of the New America Foundation. Prior to that, he was a staff writer for The New Yorker and served as managing editor of The Washington Post from 1998 to 2004. Cole became not only a Pulitzer Prize winner, but also an expert on the rise of the Taliban, the emergence of bin Laden, and the secret efforts by CIA officers and their agents to capture or kill bin Laden in Afghanistan after 1998. Ghost Wars is a nuanced study of how a small band of extremists rose to inflict incalculable damage on American soil. Malcolm Hilgartner narrates.
In some sections of the countryside, thousands of displaced refugees died of malnutrition and preventable disease because they could not reach clinics and feeding stations. And all the while, neighboring countries, Pakistan, Iran, India, Saudi Arabia, delivered pallets of guns and money to their preferred Afghan proxies. The governments of these countries sought territorial advantage over their neighbors. Money and weapons also arrived from individuals or Islamic charities seeking to extend their spiritual and political influence by proselytizing to the destitute. Ahmed Shah Massoud remained Afghanistan's most formidable military leader. A sinewy man with a wispy beard and penetrating dark eyes, he had become a charismatic popular leader, especially in northeastern Afghanistan. There he had fought and negotiated with equal imagination during the 1980s, punishing and frustrating Soviet generals. Massoud saw politics and war as intertwined. He was an attentive student of Mao and other successful guerrilla leaders. Some wondered, as time passed, if he could imagine a life without guerrilla conflict. Yet through various councils and coalitions, he had also proven able to acquire power by sharing it. During the long horror of the Soviet occupation, Massoud had symbolized for many Afghans, especially his own Tajik people, the spirit and potential of their brave resistance. He was, above all, an independent man. He surrounded himself with books. He prayed piously, read Persian poetry, studied Islamic theology, and immersed himself in the history of guerrilla warfare. He was drawn to the doctrines of revolutionary and political Islam, but he had also established himself as a broad-minded, tolerant Afghan nationalist. That September 1996, however, Massoud's reputation had fallen to a low ebb. His passage from rebellion during the 1980s to governance in the 1990s had evolved disastrously. After the collapse of Afghan communism, he had joined Kabul's newly triumphant but unsettled Islamic coalition as its defense minister. Attacked by rivals armed in Pakistan, Massoud counterattacked, and as he did, he became the blood-stained power behind a failed, self-immolating government. His allies to the north smuggled heroin. He was unable to unify or pacify the country. His troops showed poor discipline. Some of them mercilessly massacred rivals while battling for control of Kabul neighborhoods. Promising to cleanse the nation of its warlords, including Massoud, a new militia movement swept from Afghanistan's south beginning in 1994. Its turbaned, eye-shadowed leaders declared that the Quran would slay the Lion of Panjshir, as Massoud was known, where other means had failed. They traveled behind white banners raised in the name of an unusually severe school of Islam that promoted lengthy and bizarre rules of personal conduct. These Taliban, or students, as they called themselves, now controlled vast areas of southern and western Afghanistan. Their rising strength shook Massoud. The Taliban traveled in shiny new Toyota double-cab pickup trucks. They carried fresh weapons and ample ammunition. Mysteriously, they repaired and flew former Soviet fighter aircraft, despite only rudimentary military experience among their leaders. The U.S. Embassy in Kabul had been shut for security reasons since January 1989, so there was no CIA station in Afghanistan from which to collect intelligence about the Taliban or the sources of their newfound strength. The nearest station, in Islamabad, no longer had Afghanistan on its operating directive, the official list of intelligence-gathering priorities transmitted each year to CIA stations worldwide. Without the formal blessing of the OD, as it was called, a station chief like Gary Schroen lacked the budgetary resources needed to recruit agents, supply them with communications gear, manage them in the field, and process their intelligence reports. The CIA maintained a handful of paid agents in Afghanistan, but these were dedicated to tracking down Mir Amal Qazi, a young and angry Pakistani who, on January 25, 1993, had opened fire on CIA employees arriving at the agency's Langley headquarters.
That was Ghost Wars by Steve Cole. Rob Smith's debut, Child 44, was named one of the top 100 thrillers of all time by NPR, won the CWA Ian Fleming Steel Dagger Award, and was long listed for the Man Booker Prize. In Agent 6, Smith probes the tenuous border between love and obsession as one man struggles to untangle the threads of a conspiracy that shattered everything he held dear. This is an extraordinary tale, deftly capturing the intensity of the Cold War era Soviet Union. Leo Demidov is no longer a member of Moscow's secret police. But when his wife and daughters are invited on a peace tour to New York City, he is immediately suspicious. Forbidden to travel with his family and trapped on the other side of the world, Leo watches helplessly as events in New York unfold and those closest to his heart are pulled into a tragic web of political conspiracy and betrayal. In the horrible aftermath, Leo demands only one thing: to investigate the killer who destroyed his family. His request is denied. Crippled by grief and haunted by the need to find out exactly what happened on that night in New York, Leo takes matters into his own hands. It is a quest that will span decades and take Leo around the world, from Moscow, Afghanistan, and then to the back streets of New York, always in pursuit of the one man who knows the truth, Agent 6. Dennis Boutsikaris narrates.
Does a person expressing genuine delight use an abbreviation, i.e., before describing their emotions? That question was put to the suspect in his subsequent interrogation. Interrogator Borisov, how do you feel right now? Suspect, I have done nothing wrong. Interrogator Borisov, But my question was, how do you feel? Suspect. I feel apprehensive. Interrogator Borisov. Of course you do. That is perfectly natural. But note that you did not say, I feel the same as anyone would in my circumstances, i.e., apprehension. The man received 15 years, and Leo learned a valuable lesson. A detective was not limited to searching for statements of sedition. Far more important was to be ever vigilant for proclamations of love and loyalty that failed to convince. Drawing from his experiences over the past 3 years, Leo flicked through Polina Pieshkova's diary, observing that for an artist, the suspect had inelegant handwriting. Throughout, she'd pressed hard with a blunt pencil, never once sharpening the point. He ran his finger over the black of each page across sentences indented like Braille. He lifted the diary to his nose. It smelled of soot. Against the run of his thumb, the pages made a crackling noise like dry autumn leaves. He sniffed and peered and weighed the book in his hands, examining it in every way except to actually read it. For a report on the content of the diary, he turned to the trainee assigned to him. As part of a recent promotion, Leo had been tasked with supervising new agents. He was no longer a pupil, but a mentor. These new agents would accompany him on his working day and during his nighttime arrests, gaining experience, learning from him until they were ready to run their own cases. Grigory Semichastny was 23 years old and the fifth agent Leo had taught. He was perhaps the most intelligent and without a doubt the least promising. He asked too many questions, queried too many answers. He smiled when he found something amusing and frowned when something annoyed him. To know what he was thinking merely required a glance at his face. He'd been recruited from the University of Moscow, where he'd been an exceptional student, gifted with an academic pedigree, in contrast to his mentor. Leo felt no jealousy, readily accepting that he would never have a mind for serious study. Able to dissect his own intellectual shortcomings, he was unable to understand why his trainee had sought a post in a profession that he was entirely unsuited for. So mismatched was Grigory for the job that Leo had even contemplated advising him to seek another career. Such an abrupt departure would place the man under scrutiny and would, in all likelihood, condemn him in the eyes of the state. Grigory's only viable option was to stumble along this path, and Leo felt it his duty to help him as best he could. Grigory leafed through the pages intently, turning backwards and forwards, apparently searching for something in particular. Finally, he looked up and declared, "The diary says nothing." Remembering his own experience as a novice, Leo was not entirely surprised by the answer, feeling disappointment at his protege's failure. He replied, "Nothing?" Grigory nodded, "Nothing of any importance." The notion was improbable. Even if a diary lacked direct examples of provocation, the things unmentioned in it were just as important as those that were written down. Deciding to offer this wisdom to his trainee, Leo stood up. "Let me tell you a story. A young man once remarked in his diary that on this day he felt inexplicably sad. The entry was dated the 23rd of August. The year was 1949. What would you make of that?" Grigory shrugged. "Not much." Leo pounced on the claim. "What was the date of the non-aggression pact between Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia?" "August 1939. "The 23rd of August 1939, which means this man was feeling inexplicable sadness on the 10th anniversary of that treaty. Taken together with an absence of any praise for the soldiers who defeated fascism, for Stalin's military prowess, this man's sadness was interpreted as an inappropriate critique of our foreign policy."
That was Agent 6 by Tom Rob Smith. Where would we be without our spy novels? This winter, quite a few new ones have come in from the cold. Try a couple we've just heard, or check my website, bookreportradio.com, for more suggestions. I know you'll find some titles to bond with. Okay, it's really time for me to go. See you back here next week on The Book Report.